Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
It's my pleasure today to be joined by Professor Dame Sue Hill, a close friend and colleague. We're going to be talking about all things genomics at healthcare system scale. Sue, welcome onto the podcast.
Thank you, Chris, and I'm really delighted to be with you today.
Sue, I always joke that you have too many responsibilities and too many jobs for me to keep track of, but you're the Chief Scientific Officer for England. Within the NHS context, you're the Senior Responsible Officer for Genomics. You've also been playing a leadership role in NHS Test and Trace within the context of your Chief Scientific Officer role. And if that were not enough, you're also, of course, one of our country's leaders in respiratory disease research. I guess maybe my first question is, how on earth do you do all of this?
So, Chris, it is most definitely a challenge. I have to say I've left my respiratory research days behind me, even though I keep a very close eye on what's happening. And within NHS England and improvement, I'm working on many of the respiratory commitments that we have within the long-term plan or within our clinical programmes. What is really helpful, though, in terms of keeping me on the respiratory side is we do, of course, have a range of different genomic tests that apply in certain respiratory diseases. But to get back to your original question, I think, one, I like to be busy. Two, I like a challenge. And three, I think it's probably the most exciting time in healthcare that there's ever been. Not only because of the technology and the science, but because we have a pandemic that we're trying to respond to and respond to at scale and pace, which means that we can move much more quickly than what we perhaps do on other occasions.
Absolutely. And I think it's been an extraordinary year and a half just to see how rapidly some things that people thought were going to take years got done in weeks or months. And no one is born as the Chief Scientific Officer for England. Maybe just give us a few minutes on how you got inspired to get into this field and I guess some of the kind of key moments in your journey so far.
So, Chris, I always answer this question because I'm asked it at various times. One, I was always interested in science and health throughout my school days, and I was always interested in the evidence base. And I tell the story of me often asking my mother for the evidence base on which I should do certain household tasks.
I'm sure that went down well.
Yes, that was always quite an interesting point. But essentially, what I've done throughout my career is I've combined the delivery of a service to people, to patients and to our broader population, with wanting to work on an underpinning evidence base or to try and move that science and technology on. And that's involved me working with other academic collaborators, both in this country and overseas, and also with industry in becoming a principal investigator for some clinical trials at different stages of their development. But what I also did was I took on management responsibilities, and those were both within the NHS and within the university. And those management responsibilities were both about managing services, but also service improvement or indeed design of whole hospitals, as I did I was part of the design team for University Hospital Birmingham. Foundation Trust. And so then as I moved through, I also took on professional leadership roles in professional bodies, European bodies, UK bodies, and then started to work for what was then the Department of Health. And I think that led me, I think because of all the things I'd done, my whole understanding of the healthcare science workforce and some of the things that I had done to establish either education and training pathways or new service models, that put me at a moment in time in 2002 to be the right person for the Chief Scientific Officer role for England.
It's, that thing about preparation and timing, I guess, although I love the famous line from Jack Nicklaus, the golfer, who when he got in a long putt, and someone said, oh, wow, that was so lucky. And he said, well, yeah, I find the more I practice, the luckier I get. And so I'm sure it was a coincidence of timing, but a hell of a lot of hard work along the way as well.
What I would say, Chris, is even though I came into the job as CSO for England in 2002, that job has changed, especially with its move along with four other chief professional officer colleagues into NHS E&I as the hosting organisation. Then it was the NHS Commissioning Board. And so what I would say is over what is nearly a 20-year period, 19 years this year, that the role, the job, the responsibilities have evolved, and they've all actually built upon my previous experience, knowledge, skills, etc.
Absolutely. Now, Sue, you mentioned earlier that you feel it's the most exciting time to be working in healthcare. I guess the scale of the challenge, the opportunity for impact. If we think about the field of genomics specifically, in an almost perfect coincidence of timing, it was probably about 19, 20 years ago that we got the first sight of the whole human genome through the Human Genome Project. Today, we're on the verge of bringing these kinds of technologies into the mainstream of healthcare. Give us a little sense of how you've seen that science and that technology go from massive scale curiosity-driven science into the mainstream over that time period. Like, what have been some of the kind of iconic moments?
We could go back many, even back to Darwin, actually, but I'm not. I'm going since 1953, when DNA was discovered by Watson and Crick and supported by Rosalind Franklin. What happened actually was the NHS had already been focusing on genetic diseases, because in the late 1940s, the first genetic counselling clinic was set up at Great Ormond Street. But from that DNA discovery in the 1960s, NHS genetic labs were born, and their focus was on, actually at that time, whole genomes, but in the form of looking for abnormalities in chromosomal patterns. So since that time, since the discovery of DNA, with the advent of the and the funding and the initiation of the Human Genome Project in the US, but with a major contribution from the UK, we got to understand that it was possible to sequence all 3 billion plus letters, C, G, A, T, and a human genome. And so that was a possibility, but it took, over a decade or so to do that. I think the ability of services to start to look for using technologies like the Sanger sequencing technologies enables us to move from looking at whole chromosomes into looking at genes or collections of genes. And with the outcome of the Human Genome Project, coupled with the changes in data storage and analytics, we were able to really think about how that could be applied in a healthcare setting. And so I think what's been really helpful is the NHS has had, since the 60s, a genomic laboratory presence in the background, the technology, the techniques have evolved. And for example, Chris, in the 1980s, early 80s, when I was doing my PhD, I used various molecular techniques, including southern blotting, that isn't used very much at all these days. But that evolution of our technology to look at different molecular events has meant that we've had a very good platform on which we could bring evidence in. We can bring the changing technological changes into a National Health Service. That means that we were at the right place at the right time to start to collaborate with Genomics England when it was formed in the 100,000 Genomes Project.
Absolutely. And I think it's amazing to reflect on that rich history within the NHS context. And today that's focused through this rich series of services, the Genomic Medicine Service. Just tell us a little bit about the shape of that. What's the range of activities that happen in the Genomic Medicine Service, and what does that mean for patients?
So one of the things to know that, Chris, I would say is what we've been very fortunate with in this country is there's been a government interest in genomics for many decades. And it's been the investment from successive governments that has enabled us to have an infrastructure within the NHS. However, I think until we had whole genome sequencing, until we understood what was required to implement whole genome sequencing from end to end, I mean, from patient and families through sequencing analysis, validation and feedback to patients, it was really difficult to see how services needed to change. So in 2018, when we launched the Genomic Medicine Service, we recognised that there were several components that were needed, all of which couldn't be put into place at the very beginning. But at the core of it was we had to consolidate and standardise our laboratory network. And that's been consolidated now into 7 laboratory hubs with the concept of high throughput at its core, but using cutting edge technologies and being able to adopt those, but also to work with organisations like Genomics England in terms of analysis pipelines and ways in which we could benefit from research and industry collaboration. But that, of course, on its own won't work. So that another important component has been looking at our clinical genetics and genetic counselling services and how they could support a network-based approach linked to our 7 genomic laboratory hubs across England, so covering the whole of the 55 million population, and then how those clinical services can work with other clinical services and be brought into mainstream genomic medicine. But then to wrap that around with what we've now called Genomic Medicine Service Alliances that were genomic medicine centres as part of the 100,000 Genomes Project, but now just so 7 to work with the 7 genomic laboratory hubs with our 7 NHS regions, is to try and bring this together from a multi-professional clinical context, from end to end, but with the ability to incorporate new evidence, create new clinical pathways to really tackle local needs in this area that have been not perhaps had a spotlight focused on them for a long time. And all of this with the aim to provide equitable access to genomic technologies and to genomic outcomes for the population that the NHS serves. Of course, a critical part of that infrastructure is to develop the workforce and is to have within England, working with Health Education England, but also in this whole sort of genomic medicine ecosystem, to work with other countries of the UK as we think through how we mainstream.
Well, it's a rich picture that you've just painted. So I guess today you were saying that there's been this big drive to standardize, to make this accessible to everyone in England and then beyond to other parts of the UK. So you mentioned there's the seven regions of the NHS, and in each region there are both the laboratory folks who've come together with the machines and high throughput and so on, but you've also touched on those wider networks of clinical professionals and researchers and so on. It's an incredibly rich ecosystem all pulling together. From a patient perspective, what kind of issues does the Genomic Medicine Service address?
So, Chris, on one thing I was going to say when you asked me the question about the infrastructure that's been created is that what's also at the centre of our Genomic Medicine Service is a mandated genomic test directory. And that test directory outlines the eligible conditions for different genomic tests and the different genomic tests that can be applied. So that will be from single genes right through to whole genome sequencing for certain conditions. But what the launch in 2018 signaled was that for the very first time, rare and inherited genomic testing would come together with cancer genomic testing. So that isn't cancer genomic testing just for inherited cancers, so those associated with the BRCA gene, for example, but it is actually looking at the cancer tissue for genomic changes. And I reflected this week, because I presented to the National Cancer Board, at how far we've come, even in a relatively short time, so since 2018, whereby we've both unbundled the national tariff to bring all the funding for cancer genomics together. We've increased the amount of money that's available. We've also established, we've moved from single gene testing and are about to roll out, a 500 gene target panel for cancers that we can look at in a pan-cancer way. And by that, I mean looking at all different cancers. And then we've also started to look at those drug-gene interactions where people may experience an adverse drug reaction, such as in the use of a class of chemotherapy agents called the fluoropyrimidines. And therefore, we've started testing for DPYD. But that's the start, really, of a move into pharmacogenomics. We are increasingly including common diseases within our focus. So not just rare and inherited diseases, where we've expanded that scope. But for example, when including familial hypercholesterolemia, where we know the incidence in the population is about 1 in 250. But for those with a high cholesterol level, it may indicate there's a range of genomic variants that may be important in managing the patient. And I think, Chris, as we move forward, we're looking across the diagnostic spectrum from predictive prevention into diagnosis and recurrence, but also to increasingly look at how we can personalise and target medicines at the end.
It's a fascinating journey, I guess, from initially those very tightly defined hereditary diseases that have a really specific, maybe single gene cause, through to, as you say, other rare diseases, into cancer, and then broadening out into common diseases. Do you think that genetics and genomics will ultimately inform the whole of medicine, or are there areas where, you know, is there a natural kind of high watermark, so to speak, for where these technologies go?
I think there's no doubt about it, we're going to be using genomics more in common diseases. What we have to understand is how might it influence either the diagnosis that's made or the treatment or intervention. And I think as we move forward, it's those two elements that we'll be looking at. What I'm absolutely confident about saying is it will expand more than where it is today. Whether it includes the whole of healthcare, I don't think it will, But I do think we'll start to use it very differently for predictive prevention, like with polygenic risk scores, or for example, how we might use highly targeted sequencing to look at DNA fragments in the blood of individuals to detect cancer early. So there's going to be a much, much greater focus on what we can do at that end of the pathway. And I think where we will get to, Chris, and this might be in a set of defined conditions, but it could be much broader, actually, which is, I think, where we might head, is that we will use whole genome sequencing as a way for both finding diseases that we know about, but also mutations that may or may not be associated with the symptoms that people are displaying. There's a lot more work that we've got to do there, but I think whole genome sequencing really does put us in a very different place to think about how we manage population and disease-focused healthcare.
Absolutely. And bringing together these themes of prediction and prevention and whole genome sequencing, the public dialogue around newborn genome sequencing just launched recently. We've convened with your help, Sue, a group of NHS leaders to think about what this could look like in practice. Explain to us a little bit about what would sequencing newborns look like? Why might we do that? And how could that inform over time that kind of predictive and preventative approach to people's wellness, health, or response to sickness over the course of their life?
So first of all, Chris, I just want to say how important public dialogue is, not just on newborns, but in general. And that's why within the Genomic Medicine Service, we've built public and patient involvement at all levels of the infrastructure I've described, and also right up within our genomics unit in NHS England and Improvement. To answer your very specific question, what newborn screening gives us a potential to do is to particularly look for rare diseases that present themselves in children before the age of five, and where there's a very poor outcome, and often where small children have to go through multiple hospital attendances, multiple specialties before they get a diagnosis. Not in all cases can a treatment or an intervention be started, but it does give families the opportunity to think about reproductive choices, for example. So I do think being able to diagnose much earlier on gives us great potential, and hopefully would give a much better outcome for these young children and for their families. That's the first thing. The second is there's obviously an opportunity for us to think about how this might link with existing national screening programs and where whole genome sequencing might play a role there. And that has to be done in conjunction with the UK National Screening Committee and the team. But thirdly, and this does require more discussion, there is the option to start to look at other conditions that present themselves as people are going through into their teens, where it could be really beneficial, not just to the individual, but to their family, to know that they have a particular genomic mutation that leads to, for example, a high cholesterol level. So this could be a very effective way of doing that. But I think part of the dialogue we'll want to have is how much do we, for example, create a pharmacogenomic profile at birth? So drugs that should be avoided are known much early on in a patient's life, and also whether they would or wouldn't respond to certain drugs. The second is, how far do we go, and when do we start to interrogate a whole genome sequencing for other diseases that might be important in that individual's life, But what does that mean? And that's why there's a very, you know, there's a conversation that needs to happen with the screening committee on what support individuals would need, when that might happen, and whether that is something that is left to the choice of an individual when they reach a sort of adult consenting age. So I think there's lots of things that could be done, but at the moment it's important that we focus on the things which at the moment cause a problem for individuals when it's not diagnosed and where we could improve an outcome. But this is going to be a very live topic, Chris, I think, as you've said, and something where we need people, we need professionals, we need ethicists and a whole raft of individuals to be involved in this conversation.
It takes a village, right? It's a whole range of skills. I mean, if we reflect for a second on some of the topics we've just talked about, the launch of the Genomic Medicine Service in 2018, bringing in whole genome sequencing as part of that for rare diseases and cancer, these incredibly broad panels as well for the pan-cancer analysis, the potential over time to sequence newborn children and use that both for immediate screening purposes, but also potentially over someone's life course. If we bring that together with the rich history you mentioned from kind of Darwin onwards to Franklin, Crick and Watson and so on, it feels like the UK is in almost a unique position here in terms of genetics and genomics and bringing them into real everyday use in healthcare. Two questions on that. One is, you've mentioned political support and investment, but broader than that, why do you think the UK is in such a unique position? And secondly, how can we celebrate that more as a great part of the British success story? Because I'm not sure we celebrate that enough.
No, and Chris, what we have such a rich history, though, an academic history in genomics, including through UK Biobank. I think the ecosystem that we are creating together between Genomics England and NHS England and Improvement to make sure that we can continue to populate a trusted research environment with data and a mechanism for ensuring that insights can be fed back into the health system, I think is actually quite unique when we're doing this at a healthcare system level rather than at an individual healthcare organisation level. I think part of in moving forward, we need to understand how we can bring together other data sources and also other people who want to work on this, so we can make sure there always is a continual feedback loop. What I would say is we are poised, we are unique because we've got an integrated healthcare system. We've got a healthcare system, certainly in England, but I know it's the same for other countries of the UK, who have genomics at its core. And in NHS England, having a genomic medicine service within the NHS means that we have a commitment. We have many different strategies, government strategies that support this. I think all of us who are leaders in this system have to work together as we've started to set out in Genome UK, has it been further iterated in the life sciences vision. We have to work together to make sure we do keep UK great and world leading in this area, continually challenge ourselves and continually look at how things might need to change to make it better. But I think everything is there. We've got the perfect storm. We now have to ride through that and I think recognize our destination will continue to change and evolve, and we're clear about that, but we're better together than we are separately. In terms of your question about what we need to do, we don't do enough comms in this area. We don't do enough in terms of promoting good news stories and particularly the benefits, especially to individuals, of what we're doing. And I would hope, Chris, as we move forward, that we work together on an integrated communication strategy. But that includes the broader sort of science and health media. and also, of course, our government and health service communications teams, because we do have something to tell, and we need to make sure we continue to tell it, but in a way that is newsworthy, but also can demonstrate how we really are making a difference for people. Because it all comes down at the end of the day to people. The more people know about it, the more they will support more sort of ambitious aims.
And you talked about the leadership position that the United Kingdom and England have in this area. With prominent geneticists like Eric Lander now sitting alongside President Biden, with all of the investment and progress happening in China and other countries, do you think we can sustain that leadership? Or maybe a better question is, what do we need to do to sustain that leadership in a context of so much activity around the world?
So, of course, Chris, I think you and I would both say what this requires is ongoing investment, but investment at a level that enables us to do some of the proof of concept studies before we roll anything out. But then we also need to make sure that there's the investment in being able to implement at the other end. So it is a focus on and a commitment to invest into proof of concept studies and then into rapid adoption and implementation, and recognising that comes at a cost as well. And I think part of this is, how can we make sure we are cutting edge, and how can we make sure that we do the right things to understand how any genomic technology or any genomic application can be adopted into healthcare rapidly. And I always come back to the point that the 100,000 Genomes Project was taken from a proof of concept that came out of the London Olympics, with Genomics England being born in 2013, but into a project whereby in 2017, I had the conversation with the NHS England board about funding whole genome sequencing when we were still had an active project. That's the type of position that we need to be in as we go forward. But we need that early pump priming money, but recognising that downstream costs do need to be covered as well.
Yeah, so pulling things through that from an idea to a proof of concept to a kind of scale up, and then ultimately kind of whole system adoption. And as we think about that system adoption, I guess doctors, nurses, other healthcare professionals are ultimately the ones that we need to kind of fully engage. What's your view on both how that's already happening and what more needs to happen with the workforce?
I think what's really helpful in this country, we have the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges that brings together all the Royal Colleges. I think we've got a commitment from the Academy and their constituent Medical Royal Colleges to work with us. And that's with us from an NHS system level. That's really important, because we need ownership and leadership from all professional groups in this as we go forward. And I think part of our commitment to really mainstreaming genomic medicine in the NHS was the creation of these genomic medicine service alliances that have at their core multi-professional leadership. That's the critical part, because this involves a multi-professional team to deliver. We do need investment in the workforce, there's no doubt about it. We do need to understand the workforce that's required of the future and the new skills. So we need a prospective supply. We need development of the existing workforce and an understanding of how they contribute and what that means for their roles. But we also need to make sure that we continue to support clinical academic careers. And I think if we bring all of this together, then we will have champions and advocates for genomic medicine in a way that we haven't had. And that's one of the reasons why we've created the infrastructure we have, and we've funded education and training and workforce development posts within it.
Absolutely. As you say, the more that embeds ultimately, the more patient stories, human stories, we can continue to see kind of develop with happy endings, which I guess is what it all comes down to. I think your point earlier about storytelling and communication is really important. This podcast is one of the ways in which we're trying to have more conversations about genomics with people from all walks of life. As we continue to do that, what are either some themes or even some individual people who you think, whose voices you think we should try to help amplify through this dialogue?
So there's no doubt about it, Chris, we need to amplify the voices of patients. What we do know is there are some high profile individuals who either have genetic conditions or have been the recipients of genomic testing. You know, for example, if they've had cancer. I think it's really important that we do start to frame this in the benefit end of this. But I think if we look across the environment we're working in, there's no doubt about it. There's more work we need to do with our political leaders. There's more work, I think, and there's an appetite from some of the conversations I've been having to engage parliamentarians in both houses in the UK. And then I'm really keen to see that we start to have an ongoing dialogue with our general population, because this needs to be a big conversation. It doesn't need to be limited. But I think what we need to do is, throughout the infrastructure that's being created, have an integrated communications plan, but that can feed up, but that at a national level, we recognise and we celebrate genomics at every opportunity. And we use those sort of high profile events. You know, Chris, I'm all for creating awards and recognition. And I think we need to think about what type of awards would we might want to introduce for genomics,
because
it is seen often as a niche area, but it could be made very, very attractive.
Well, Sue, that's a really inspiring vision. We'll talk to the pewter smelters and get some big cups made up. Thank you so much for coming onto the pod today, and thank you for everything you're doing for the whole field.
And thank you, Chris, and thank you for everything that you're doing in Genomics England. And it's a real pleasure working so closely with you and your team.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.